Well, good evening, everyone, and welcome to the April AES UK lecture. Now, I don't suppose I need to introduce the gentleman on my right to any of you. His name is synonymous with audio processing through Root of Ercam, SSL, Oxford Digital, Sony. I'm just an old television boffin, but this gentleman on the right was the last person in Van Mildert College, Durham, that you needed to get up for breakfast. He lived underneath me. Just a couple of little housekeeping points. First of all, the usual fire exits you'll see there. No fire practice, so if the alarm does go off, it's for real. And if I could just pass this round to record your attendance. And in having said that, I'll introduce Peter Eastie.
Thank you, John. Wow, all those years ago. Well, what a lovely gig for a comedy. You know, if I die, at least they can tell me why. Oh, it's going to be difficult. Okay. Okay, that's me. Any rude comments, insulting letters, demands for money, send them there and I'll ignore them. Anything else, I do reply to email, so if you want anything, that's the place to go. What DSP, why so hard? What do we do? Why do I think I can talk about this subject? Well, Oxford Digital's a little bunch, and we do two or three things. One of which is to design DSP cores that we sell to semiconductor companies, who then put them into products and sell them to the great unwashed. And eventually, some many years later, royalty eventually filters back to us when we've nearly gone bust, but not quite. It's a long, slow food chain. But in the process of designing your own DSPs, you get to learn some things about it. And the other thing we do is we do contract programming of DSP, mainly for semiconductor manufacturers who've got 30-year-old processor designs that they're still trying to get money out of. Well, maybe 20-year-old. They've got stuff designed in the 80s, and it's got an architecture from the 80s and an assembler from the 80s, and they want to put modern processing on it. And it is so foul to program. We have documented cases of experienced engineers producing one line of code per day. One line a day. It is possible to design processors and tools that are so awful that that happens. And people have done it. That's where I began in the 70s. It's the electronic music studios, EMS, the people who made synths for Pink Floyd and all those funny people. And the object what I was building was this thing in the middle here. It's a power supply, a couple of racks of a 192-channel synthesizer, a couple of racks of 128-channel analyzing filter bank, some controls and a GUI, two 16-bit ADCs in a 3U rack, sorry, in a 2U rack, two 16-bit DACs in a 2U rack. That was state-of-the-art, guys. And a scope, because the one I put in there died from overheating, because I'd forgotten about the ventilation. So that's where we were and what we were designing in the 70s. And here we are all these years later, and we've learned something about processor design. Not by any means all, and please shout, you know, throw things. If you've got questions or rude comments, just interject. Don't feel you have to wait till the end. Who are our customers? You can look on our website and it'll tell you, and it'll have names like Wolfson and TI and all sorts of people like that. We don't do the same things for anybody, and we don't talk about what our customers do. We are up the rear end in NDAs. So if ever I mention something about what went on in somebody's processor or somebody's tools, you can be absolutely certain it's not one of our customers, or it's something by one of our customers that's in the public domain already. if you deal with semiconductor companies who have enormous turnovers and enormous quantities of lawyers, you get to be very good about what you say in public. So you were interested in the client list, go have a look at the website. Let's get on to what we do. We make things sound better some of the time, and that little telephone there being listened to by those two strange gentlemen, one of our first phones, that's what they looked like when they heard it. You might recognise them. It was an amusing phone, this thing down here. It's a Sony Bravia telephone. It's got a big menu of things it does. Being a telephone is number 6. Really is. And it's got a sodding great big screen and receives DVB-H and all sorts of other odd things. The most amusing part about that one was they... And I'll use a different phone to... Had a screen on the front, and they wanted us to improve the stereo. Now, the first thing they said was, we're very sorry, the screen was big, the loudspeakers are on the back. They said, well, okay, we'll try. You then turned it round, and the loudspeakers were on the back, one above the other. At which point we said, I think there's a limit to how good we can make the stereo out of this thing. But that's the kind of area we're in. And let's go on. I've done something stupid. Oh, I know what I've done. I've confused Microsoft. I don't get any prizes for that, apparently. And of course, you, who am I primarily talking to? I want to be talking to either people who design signal processors, people who design the programming environments for signal processors, or people who program signal processors to do audio. If you want a programmer to do video, you're in the wrong building. Okay, why I jump up and down about productivity, and the reason I do it is because people are expensive and silicon's cheap. I can buy, at present rates, a square meter of silicon for what I have once paid somebody in this room for a year's labor. And if you think how many chips you can get out of a square meter of silicon, you have an impression of what the equation is between the engineer hour and how many chips you have to ship out of the factory to pay for that engineer hour. So it really is getting to be very important to be able to use engineers to program DSP efficiently. The other reason we have to do it is because people are slow and silicon's fast. Once upon a time, when silicon was slower, you know, when clock rates were slower, and everything took longer to do, I was looking at a processor that took 10.8 microseconds for an instruction recently. That's a historical one. Something under 100 kilohertz processor rate. At the point now where processors are so quick, an AMD will flog you a Blackfin for Thrupp's Apeny that does 600 MIPS or whatever. The whole reason to spend engineering hours to economize on nanoseconds has changed. We shouldn't need to put as much human power into doing something. And the other thing is, people are slow and computers are fast. Computers can do a better job. If somebody will write the sodding compiler, it's going to be better for you to program in high-level language than in assembler. And I'm going to keep ranting on about that to you until you're sick of it. Programmer efficiency gets you time to market, and that gets you the market. If you're 6 months late in lots of markets, the other bugger's already taken your customers away. And this is the one that sells what we do to the managers in companies. Because the managers can understand. You know, maybe they're not so worried about the way the R&D bill goes. Maybe they're not so worried about that sort of thing. But they're desperately worried about missing their target. And if you're selling, for instance, when I worked for Sony, if you're selling into Japan, they do the 13th month. Everybody gets two wage packets in December. So if you miss getting your product out for Christmas, you basically don't sell any. It's that bad. So time to market is the thing, and that's what we're trying to go towards. Targets move. Whatever management say, whatever product management says to the engineer, when they come down and tell you, we want it to do this, don't believe the bastards. They're going to change their mind. If you're lucky, they will change their mind early in the R&D process. If you're not, they'll change their mind right at the bloody end. So I'll give you three stories about this one. The first one goes back to that picture of that studio. That big synthesizer thing I was pointing at, which I did in the 70s, was basically a big additive synthesis machine. It took me about 3 years to build, many late nights and sleeping in a sleeping bag under the machine. And I eventually got it working. 6 months later, John Chowning published FM Synthesis. My machine wouldn't do it. I just spent 3 years making a fixed program machine that was redundant in 6 months' time. So I don't make fixed function machines anymore. Another one. A phone manufacturer came to us and said, we need chip that does bass enhancement. Because, you know, these little things, they've got, you know, a transducer the size of the end of your finger, hole in the case the size of a rat's anus, and they want to get bass out of it, yes? Right. And you look at the transducer and it rolls off from a kilohertz. Really does. So anyway, they said they wanted all sorts of bass enhancement built into this chip. We said, well, look, we don't do fixed program chips anymore for various historical reasons, but we'll do you a programmable chip and then we'll put a program in it to do bass enhancement. We were about halfway through that machine. They come along and say, customer doesn't want bass enhancement. Customer wants louder. Customer wants stereo widening. Customer wants custom EQ modes. What about the bass enhancement? Oh, I don't need it. Luckily, we could just change the program in the chip. So again, this is don't build fixed function machines. And the last one, we had a customer who built a phone with everything in. It received telly, it played movies, it played music, it made the tea. I mean, it did just about everything. And this was the early days, and the only way they could interface all the objects inside this cell phone was in analog. It's got so many different clocks and clock domains and stuff, they couldn't work out how to do digital interfacing. So this thing had analog interfacing with all these blocks. And we did the processing for them, and away they went. 3 weeks before mass production was due to start, I have four Japanese gentlemen on my doorstep who've just got off a plane from Tokyo. We have problem. Okay. When we put this in movie mode, now movie mode was designed to do dynamic range compression because movies are mixed for theaters and they want to listen on the Yamanote line. You know, loud, in the tube, noisy background. So of course, what do? You put a compressor on this thing. The effect of the compressor is of course to bring up the gain of the quiet bits of the movie, whereupon, being analog mixing of all the signals inside, it's listening to its own transmitter. So we said, okay, guys, look, we'll build you a noise gate. What you need is a noise gate. So I sketched a noise gate on a whiteboard, gave it to a young engineer who's still with us. He was a lot younger then. And he programmed it in half an hour later, using the graphical programming that we use, but just something that's non-assembler and non-machine specific. So we used 11 instructions out of a 1,000 instruction processor on that. So we used 1% of the DSP, put the noise gate, stereo noise gate in, programmable attack and decay and all those things, 11 instructions. And the four Japanese gentlemen turned around, left our building and went straight back to Heathrow. very, very, very happy. Of course, they could have just phoned us up and asked us or sent us an email, but they were in such a panic, they decided they all had to come. So that's another reason why not to build fixed program machines. So never, ever build a fixed function device. The other one is third-party algorithms. Whether they're public domain stuff or whether they're the very secret stuff, like, you know, you buy a telly, it's got a big cardboard box, and there are these square logos all printed along the side, names of various companies, most of them American, who promise to do something wonderful with the sound that comes out of this telly. You will have to put all of those in. They will change. The customer will come along and say, I know I said I wanted Mumbleton and so-and-so's iSimulator Stadium, but now I'd want Thingy and Doodah's Here is a theatre. And so they'll hand you this piece of example code from these people and want it in. So it's another good reason, always build programmable. Okay, what's an audio signal? Well, it's a known bandwidth, a known resolution, a known number of channels. And why don't I enumerate them? Because they vary. But we roughly know what we mean by audio. Where do we do this? Large mixing, cell phones, hi-fis, TVs, player docks, the bloody PC. You know, these are the sorts of places where all this processing gets used. What processing do we do? Well, it's a continuously varying signal against time. You know, you put it on an oscilloscope, it does that. So we can do filtering to it. We can calculate polynomials on it to sort of put it through bent functions. We can do nonlinear things, things like absolute value and that sort of stuff. And we can make decisions. You know, the signal is above or below a certain level, do some different processing. But what we don't do, and we always want it yesterday, or at least with low delay. The reason we want it low delay in a phone is because all the bastard wireless modem people have eaten all the delay spec. You know, there's a really hard specification for what the delay is in the system, and everybody else has gobbled it up. So by the time you get to do any audio processing in a phone, you have no delay left that you can put in. And that means nothing block structured. As my life, I've done maybe one or two projects in 40 years that involve block structured processing. Then again, I've not been involved in the whole psychoacoustic compression thing.
What do you mean block structured?
FFTs, that sort of stuff. The stuff that's based around the idea that audio is somehow best represented by a linear arrangement of frequencies. Bats, as far as I know. But
so how, if that's the case,
yep.
Can you use, say, you know, inverse FFTs and that sort of stuff?
Don't need them. Don't go through block structuring, because the one thing you can be absolutely sure of, it's got a loader delay and it's got artifacts. Yes, if you do an FFT and an inverse FFT and you butt them all together nicely, you will invent the perfect piece of wire and the numbers you put in will come out. But as soon as you process in the frequency domain, you've then introduced a load of artifacts. There's a battle to keep them down, but I've spent 40 years doing what's basically always been time domain processing. There's good places for frequency domain processing, a lot of the psychoacoustic stuff, but even then, we've been doing things like filter banks instead of FFTs for a lot of stuff. May come on to that. What hardware have we got? Well, we've got memory, we've got multipliers, we've got connections, that's it. Oh, yeah, there are adders and things, but they're so trivial, nobody cares. If you're designing silicon, the things that cost you are the memory, the multipliers, and the wires. A friend actually one day said, I don't care how much the transistors cost, how much are the wires? Because getting the connectivity around on a chip, particularly if you're handling socking great big wide buses, is expensive. You know, an adder's a tiny little thing, it's a few dozen transistors and it's done. Multipliers are a bigger thing, and so are memories. Data types for DSP, that, for those who don't know him, is Bristow Johnson, Robert, Dr. DSP. Look him up on the web, he's a genius. And see all his stuff on Headroom and Floating Point. Look, I didn't spit when I said Floating Point, isn't that good? RBJ. For audio, for what we do, Floating Point is bloody useless. We are trying to do quality processing of an audio signal, which means our major, major enemy is nonlinearity and distortion and things that go bump in the night. And Floating Point, by its very definition, changes its accuracy depending on where you are in the waveform. So it's a lovely device for producing intermodulation. Floating Point is like, if you don't know what you're doing yet, because you're doing experiments, then Floating Point is lovely. Because you can just ignore how big the signal is and do your thinking work. Great. But if you're coming down to putting something on a small piece of silicon with minimum power and minimum area, because they're both money, then you're going to end up in Floating Point. You're going to end up in Fixed Point. Word length. If I'm going Fixed Point, what word length do I want? 16 and 32 are lovely computer numbers, but they've got bugger all to do with audio. Audio is about signal to noise at the particular signal you're using. And 16 and 32 are great if you happen to want 96 and 192, roughly, dB. But if you've got a signal that wants 120 dB, you don't want either of these numbers. Because if you do it in that one, you haven't reached your spec. And if you do it in that one, you're throwing away a third of the silicon. So structuring data path widths to match audio is a key one. I mean, people have been doing this for years. Even, you know, think back to the old 56K. It came out as a 24-bit machine. All sorts of other odd Rococo sizes have been used. The core we sell people does everything from 16 to 48. And you basically say how many bits you want on your audio. And we've got customers at 16 and we've got customers at 48. The 48 guy is a hi-fi loony and is more into specmanship than anything else, and 16 guys in telecoms. And the same people are in 28, 34 sort of range, doing quite nicely processing audio. Languages for DSP. Okay. C is not a language intended for signal processing. In fact, it's not even a very good language for signal processing. It has no concept of time. Audio is all about time, delivering the signal on time. You know, you're browsing the internet, something's late by a couple of milliseconds, who cares? You're doing digital video, you get a frame doubled, who cares? Who can even notice apart from the pros? You get audio, you get something 10 milliseconds late, it's a ruddy great big click. If you can make an audio transport mechanism and an audio network first, then if you want to put computer data or digital video on it, you'd probably work. Because the audio network has the hardest spec. But going back to C, C just ain't the right language for doing DSP in. C++ kind of could be, because you can get the right operators into it by defining them. One of the problems with the C integer types is you can't get at the top end. What you want to do doing a piece of DSP in Fixed Point is to get the top end of the multiplier, the most significant half of the multiplier. C has no way of offering you this without doing some amazing contortions. And since multiply is one of those things you do all the time, you don't want an amazing contortion for something you do every second instruction. There's never a need for assembler. There isn't. Stop it immediately. Anybody who's still a student, they're trying to teach you assembler. Shout at them. Tell them they're wrong. Tell them I say so.
Can you get them to reprint their bloody data sheets for DSP? So we don't have the solid assembler in there.
That'd be a good one. Yeah.
Because everyone that I've come across is full of completely useless assembly code that I can't understand.
Yes, I take your point. Yes, I've got some examples of that coming up. You're dead right. Of course, if you're stuck with very old hardware and only an assembler exists because somebody's designed a processor for which a compiler cannot be written, then you may have to come to us and get us to program it for a small fortune for you. And we will. But you will then be a large semiconductor company who's got a host of signal processor designs that they can't throw away and have to keep going. We know of semiconductor companies where the cost of porting the library to a new chip is greater than the cost of designing the new chip. The tools maintenance is higher than the cost of a new version of a chip. At which point you kind of know that something's going to give in a few years' time. Right, the classic. Our DSP comes with a C language IDE, programmable in C. You've seen them, the bastards. They'll tell you it's programmable in C, and then they'll show you a piece of code that looks like that. The other one they do is they come up, they don't give you it as C wrapper on assembler. Instead, they'll give you nice functions that actually expose the bottom level. The other place you'll see this sort of thing is in the example code for some effects. Because if you're trying to communicate a particular DSP algorithm to somebody and you don't know what processor they're going to put it on, then that actually works quite nicely because you can make an executable specification in C, runs like a snail on a bicycle, but at least it makes the right bits. And then some programmer who knows whatever your target machine is can replace these with the appropriate assembler from his particularly arcane processor design. So that's not C either. And this one certainly isn't. You know, the one where they provide you socking great big library objects that you can't get into. You know, yes, it's programming in C. Oh, you want to do an FFT, sir? Well, to get any efficiency at all, call our FFT routine. No, you can't see the insides. The semiconductor manufacturer will have paid for some programmer to write that routine, squeeze it as much as possible, and then hand it to you. Yes, you've got a C callable routine, but you can't go in there and furkle with it. And that's where the optional extensions come interesting. You'll get somebody who gives you a processor that is actually programmable in real C, but it's inefficient. He'll then say, well, if you want efficiency, we've got this optional extension that allows you to do something more efficiently than you can express it in C, because our compiler can't match up your C source with this clever instruction we've put in to do the thing you're wanting to do. So they'll then give you an optional extension. Perfectly programmable in C, sir, but if you want efficiency, here's an optional extension. Problem is, as soon as you've used the optional extension, it's not optional anymore. You can't move to a different company's processor because you just built your product around an optional extension that comes only with one type of processor. So you've then tied yourself in to that particular manufacturer. There is at least one university teaching DSP in Fortran and assembler, and they apologized for the Fortran. Wrong. At least Fortran isn't machine specific. Well, most Fortrans aren't. It's the assembler that's the problem. Yes, if you want a job as a compiler writer and you're doing computer science, then yes, you need to know about assembler and architectures and all that thing. But if your job is audio and DSP, you shouldn't be down there. So I don't know the perfect DSP language. If anybody knows one, or even an imperfect DSP language, we're very open to a discussion on that one, maybe when we get to the end. But any high-level language is better than any machine-specific language. And if you've got multiple memory banks, you know, you're building a DSP. It's got this multiplier in the middle and maybe some adders and maybe some other stuff, and they're hungry. They want variables all the time. You know, your multiplier will eat two variables every clock tick. You've got to get them from somewhere. Your memory bandwidth runs out, so you go, oh, I know, I'll do multiple memory banks. Keep my multiplier fed. You know, Think of the 56K again from Motorola. Problem about that is you'll then hand to the programmer the problem of making sure that whenever he does a multiply, the multiply wants variables that are in different memory banks. This is a horrible pattern matching problem, best done by a computer and not by a human brain. So your programming environment for doing DSP in shouldn't have you worrying about memory banks. That arcane silliness is what computers is good at. The multiply add, a lovely object, it's going on the way to another. If you've got a multiply add in your DSP, I would sincerely advise you that the multiply and the multiply add is the same as the multiply that's just a multiply. You know, if you want to multiply three things together, you're going to have a multiply chained with a multiply. If you want to do a multiply add, A times B plus C, if I compare A times B times C with A times B plus C, I would like the A times B to produce the same numbers in both those statements. But a whole load of machines, they don't. Because the multiply will go short thing times short thing makes big thing. Can't put the big thing in my multiplier, so I'll make that into a short thing, then do short thing times short thing goes. Whereas if I do multiply add, I'll go short thing times short thing makes big thing. I can put the big thing in my adder because the adder was cheap because I made a big one. So we would like all the multipliers, wherever you're using them, to be the same. Limiting. Whatever number system you use, you're going to have to limit. Or rather, whatever number system you use, eventually you will do something that goes out of range. In fixed point, it'll get too big. In floating point, it can get too big. It can also get too small. It's an even worse situation. But you will eventually bang your head on the end of the number range. And something intelligent has to be done. If you fold it over, it's generally less nice than if you limit. Also, if you've got any people who are old enough that they ever did analog design, they'll sort of have more sympathy with the idea it bangs its head on the roof than I add two 10-volt numbers, and instead of getting 15-volt number, I get a minus 5-volt number. So we're going to have to limit at some point. And you need to do it after everything that can make anything bigger. So that's a multiplier, an adder, a subtract, absolute value. Well, absolute value makes things bigger because most of the number systems we're using are asymmetrical. Most of the number systems have a single zero. And if you take 2 to the n and subtract one value for the single zero, you get 2 to the n minus 1, which is odd. You can't spit an odd number of numbers equally either side of zero. So you'll end up with one number on one side or the other that doesn't have the opposite polarity of number to go with it. So you'll get this lovely one. How many people have tripped over this one? There are a whole host of DSPs out there that will do that in fixed point because they've got a true minus one in their representation, but no true plus one. Because when you do the fractional twos complement multiply, the range you get, the answer you get from here will actually have one more bit in it, in the word width, than your native word width. And a lot of DSPs will just throw that extra bit away. You really will get minus one times minus one equals minus one. And the DSP will hand you this. I claim if it does that, it's a ruddy awful DSP. But almost every DSP in the world does it. Except ours. Pipelines. Please don't burden the user of your DSP with pipelines. I can see at least one person nodding and I know why. Pipelines are lovely. They allow you to do wonderful things in designing your DSP. But no human being should ever get to see this. The DSP we make in one of its larger forms has a 13 deep pipe. No human being can program a processor with a 13 deep pipe in assembler. You know, you write the instruction and 13 instructions later, the result becomes valid. Your head won't do it. But if you've got a decent compiler and a decent way of doing it, you can have deep pipes and it just works. This line used to say variable pipelines are always wrong. Having sat back since I gave this chat the first time, met somewhere where they worked. Pipelines in general should not be seen by the programmer. If they are, then you're probably using a tool set that isn't up to the job. A pipeline isn't a panacea. If you've got a 200 clock sample and a 5-deep pipe, then if you make a chain of instructions, you can only get 40 of them done before you have to be finished. 200 divided by 5 is 40. So in a filter loop or something, there is a limit to the number of instructions you can do, and a pipeline doesn't get you out of that problem. The pipelines are useful for some things, but not everything. You can push code through branches when you're a clever assembly language programmer. You shouldn't need to know about that. And we've met many machines that use pipelines for parameter passing. In fact, we met one machine where the manufacturer did not know the length of the pipe. God's honest truth. We had a machine turn up where the manufacturer didn't know the length of the pipe. And we ended up, one of their engineers wrote a program. And it went, store 7 in A, store 6 in A, store 5 in A, store 4 in A, store 3 in A, store 2 in A, store 1 in A, output A. And the idea was that this piece of code would output the length of the pipe. Because if it was a 5-deep pipe, the output you got at the end would be the output that was written 5 instructions previously. And we actually had to run this piece of code in order to find out how deep the pipe was before we could carry on work. There are some terrible things out there. So the definition of the pipeline length is from when you do one instruction to when you can use it. And everybody's kind of agreed on that now. Short-circuiting the pipe, there's somebody in this room who thought of this one, was a way of comparing addresses of things that are going through a pipeline, finding they're the same and short-circuiting the pipe so you can bring a variable back more quickly. It can be really useful. If anybody wants to go into the arcaneness of that, I can point you at the right human. One of the neat things you can do, suppose I've got a 1,024 length instructions and a 7-deep pipe. If I do instruction 0, that gets used by instruction 7, which gets used by instruction 14, all the way to the end, and then can get used by instruction 1, 8, etc. So you can unwrap the pipe to make a machine that looks to the programmer as though it's unpipelined. Alternatively, if they're not relatively prime, you can end up with the XMOS machine, where you run multiple threads on one machine, and every thread looks as though it's not pipelined, where in fact you're running multiple threads in a single processor. Branching. Branching causes hell. Particularly if you're looking at time. Time is important in audio. Once we start branching, it's very hard to know what the time is, how long things will take. And if you are going to do branches and pipelines, you have a real problem that you need to keep away from the programmer. And they will break your guaranteed timing. Conditional execution works slightly better. First met that in Andy Mora's ASP that he did for Lucasfilm, since used by ARM. You know, the bit that says, do I execute this instruction or not? Keeps the timing going, keeps the pipeline full. Very useful for audio. You'll need condition codes to match, but at least it keeps your timing right. The multiplexer is the other thing that works nicely. It's a 3-input instruction. Does that. C programmers, please recognize. It's a multiplexer. If the control input's positive, take this value. If the control input's negative, take the other value. Works rather nicely. And you don't need special condition codes because it uses an ordinary variable. But why have I written less than 0 up there, less than or equal to 0 there? This is the problem of the infinite gain instruction. Doesn't happen in analog. Analog's kind of continuous. As you change something, the output changes. There may be a huge, great bit of gain, but with these sorts of instructions, you can get one LSB of difference can completely change the result, which is something you don't get in analog unless you put a really high gain amplifier on a noisy source. The absolute instruction, there's a lovely one here for those of you who program. Right, I am a graph of input versus output. Here I am, linear. Yep. This is 0, 0. I want to do a function that does that. So it's got a different slope below 0 than it has above. Traditionally, programmers end up comparing it with 0 and selecting one or two multiplier factors and all sorts of things. But what I can do is I can take an absolute instruction, 45 degrees, returns the positive of whatever you put in, scale that down by a bit, add the original thing on, and I've got the curve I was looking for. It's remarkably quick and easy to do. It saves you a conditional. It comes down to two or maybe three instructions to do a curve break. It's commonly used in a lot of DSP that you don't see because it's proprietary. We use it a lot. So if you're programming anything that requires breakpoints, things like dynamic sections, where you want a limiter, you want the gain on a limiter to change, you don't need conditionals to do it. Ha-ha! The unholy selection. Truncation, rounding, dither, all that stuff. Do you do it for every instruction? Or do you do it just for the output? Our answer on this one is we do it just for the output. You put enough bits in, particularly for things like noise shaping and dither, so that you don't worry. But I'm going to assume fixed point because floating point's hard. Doing reasonable dithered truncation and things on floating point is just too difficult for the average human being. Truncation's easy, but it gives you a little DC offset because you've blown away some things, and that DC offset can build up. We've had that happen in our filters a couple of times. Truncation towards zero. There's even an IEEE thing for it. It's crossover distortion. Once you have done it, you can never correct it. You have buggered your signal up wrong. Rounding towards zero is wrong in all audio circumstances, even for the people who say, but I need it to stop my filter producing idle tones. The reason your filter is producing idle tones is you haven't dithered or noise shaped it correctly, and you can't cure that with rounding towards zero. Go back, do it again. Half LSB offset number systems get rid of several things. That's where you have a completely symmetrical number system that's just a little bit off. So you have the same number of samples left and right, above and below zero, and each is half an LSB from where it would be. Rather like sine magnitude. Rounding wins for the whole lot. Dither! Simple subject. Thank you, Stanley. Thank you again for dither. Do I want truly random dither, or do I want pseudo-random dither, or do I want to run a hash table from my audio? What colour would I like it to be? Brown, white, pink, green, orange? What PDF do I want? And I'm not meaning horrible file format. I mean, what probability density function do I want for my dither? There are so many sorts of dither. If you try and build the dither into your silicon, you will guarantee that somebody will come along and ask for one you haven't built in. Every time. The other one to do is make sure your dither is uncorrelated. We once did see somebody who put correlated dither on a multi-track tape recorder. It's absolutely wonderful. Whatever you did, the noise was dead center in the stereo image. Bill knows about this one. You've got to have uncorrelated dither. There's been papers on it. But the real problem is the test guys in silicon want repeatability. If you say you want to build something that's genuinely random into a piece of silicon, they'll come after you with a hatchet because they can't test the bloody thing. So you've got to put something in that's enough like random that it fools your ear, but enough predictable that you can still test the silicon. And again, those infinite gain components, the things that have a real slicing level to them, can blow your dither up to very big proportions if you get it wrong. Rounding wins, at least for us. Rounding internally wins, and you dither on the outputs and you give it back to the program and say, how do you want to build your dither? That way you duck all those questions about what color and what type. Noise shaping, it's pretty similar, but you know, what shape do you want it? What order do you want it? Again, the test guys want repeatability, and the problem about noise shaping is it's got history back to the day you pressed reset. So unless you're willing to make every one of your tests re-zero in the machine and carry on any audio signal that's using noise shaping, there's variability from the year dot still in your signal. Again, rounding wins. But please make sure your instruction set can do dither and noise shaping. We know processors that can't. There's nothing in, they've been built as audio processors and there's no masking. So I can't separate two parts of the word. At the point where you can't separate the bits that are going straight to the output from the bits that you're chopping off, you can't really build a noise shaper. And to build an audio processor that won't do noise shaping is a bit silly. Coefficient interpolation. It would be lovely if all forms of digital audio processing used constant coefficients and constant processing, but they don't. Somebody will put a hand on the end and give them a twagger to vary it. Coefficients are a sampled system. Just like the audio is a sampled system, we put a piece of plastic or metal there and we go, at it, and we sample it 48,000 times a second or whatever. Nobody'd sample above a megahertz, would they? Be foolish. The other one is the piece of plastic, the volume knob. And that's another piece of plastic I'm moving with a human. So, of course, you have to sample it regularly. It's just like the microphone thing. Unfortunately, you sample these two things for efficiency reasons at very different sample rates. And so you're going to put in a sample rate converter called interpolation to bring the slowly sampled one you moved your hand with up to the rate of the fast one, the audio, so you can make a volume control. If we can't make a volume control, we can't do anything. However you do it, you'll spend two or three instructions computing the sample rate converter, the interpolation of the coefficient, to run one multiplier that's making your volume control. So suddenly, I don't really care what the DSP is. It's the coefficient calculation and the coefficient interpolation, which is going to consume all my power, if I've got something where every coefficient can change every time. Big mixing console, nothing for it. At the end of a big automated recording session, every fader is moving every frame because the guys kept going over it, juggling everything. You know, it's a little iPod dock. Yeah, you can do different things. So it depends what you're doing. Only in exceptional circumstances will you end up with hardware for doing interpolation. Linear interpolation does work. It's quite easy to do. A lot of people use first order because that's even simpler to think about. Coefficient synchronization. If you've got one thing, the frequency control on a filter, and it's making five or more coefficients to go into the DSP, all those coefficients have to arrive together. You've got to synchronize them. Again, you can do it with linear or first order filters, but please remember to do it or it'll make really horrible noises. It's a synchronous sampling problem. You wouldn't expect to sample the two channels of a stereo signal with independent sample rates. Neither would you expect to sample different coefficients going in with different sample rates. Coefficient synchronization. If I've got two or more things running at the same time and they don't sample at the same time, it's jitter. Guy McNally, when he was at Neve, when he was at the BBC, did a wonderful test. You take any digital audio product, you build yourself a good 1 kHz oscillator, and you put it in. And where you get the signal out, you build yourself a good, preferably synchronous, 1 kHz notch filter. And you listen to the output. Silence. And then you take the volume control and turn it. You would be amazed at some of the horrible things you will hear. Because as you change the gain, you're doing a modulation between a moving signal and the sine wave. So it has, it can't but make that sine wave broader. And the question is how it makes it broader in the frequency domain. And some of them will go, and some of them will go. You'll get wonderful noises. It's so simple to do once you've made the oscillator and the notch filter. I encourage you to do it on anything you've got that does DSP. It works on filters as well, because if your filter is working correctly, it's not changing the frequency going through, it's just changing the amplitude. And that way you can listen to the rubbish that the filter is doing, because the notch takes out sine wave, and then you can listen to the rubbish. And the Mark I human ear is a really good... You don't need all these clever psychoacoustic evaluation computer programs to tell you how awful it is. You can use a Mark I ear, and you'll know which you'd prefer. Anyway, I put the mouse down and it's disturbed Microsoft. Good. I'm going to gallop a bit. Multiple pros. I was at a wonderful lecture by Brian Kernighan, he of the C programming language, and also of the language Orc. K in Orc is Brian. And he began it with, there are some problems that are too big for 10 lines of Orc, even very long lines. It's a language that encourages people to do that. There are some problems that are too big for one DSP. You're going to have to use more than one. It's quite common now. We even see it inside common consumer devices. More than one audio DSP to do what everybody needs done. And so not everything fits, but automatic segmentation is possible. We've done it. We've done it for 400 processors. We did it as part of the Sony OXFR3 mixing console. It can be done. No human ever partitioned the problem on that. It went over 400 processors, and it was programmed in the compiler to solve the segmentation problem. It's hard to do. You know, we spent at least a couple of man years doing that with one very clever guy. If the processors are not identical, it's very, very, very hard. And we actually have a case, or we know of a case of a semiconductor manufacturer who makes a dual processor chip where the two processors are almost but not completely similar. They're similar enough that it cons you into the fact that you can do anything on either of them. And they're dissimilar enough that it comes and bites you in the bum when you get it wrong. So if you have to put multiple processors into your product, please put the same one in. Makes life so much easier. If you've got multiple processors and they just run along in lockstep, it's really easy to pass things between them. But only if you've got a sensible compiler. So the two processors start together and they run down through a couple of hundred instructions, and then this one says send and that one says receive. And you pass the variable between the two. Now imagine doing that in assembler. Oh, I've put another instruction in up here. I've not noticed I've moved all the sends one later. Everything stops working. And you manually count down. And you end up in the comment fields of every line of the assembler writing the time delay to that point. And then you compare the two programs to put the send and receive in the right place. No, I'm not making it up. We really had to do it. And once you've got conditional branches and things in there, it's hell on earth. But a compiler can do it easily. Really easily. It's just counting. Computers can do that. If you're going to have multiple processors, do you arrange them in a long chain for what I would call a long, thin, snake-like algorithm? Or do you arrange them in parallel for a sort of mixing console, lots of channels in parallel? You can bet your bottom dollar, whichever way you arrange the processors, the application guy will want them the other way. So just stick them in a mesh, bung them around a router. Routers are actually cheap in silicon. And then you can allow the application guy to connect them together as he wants and to put the I.O. in. I once made a mistake and put the I.O. on one particular processor. And of course, it was horrible. We spent most of our time moving the input signals through to get to the place where it was actually needed. If you make the I/O available for any processor, you get around that. Elementary stuff. When you're writing assembler, it's really hard to remember that you use that very... You know, we went through a piece of somebody's code. It had five declarations of pi. In fact, to be truthful, they all this code wasn't made by the same guy, but it was in the same project. You know, software tools will find this and say, let's just have one. Humans writing assembler don't find it. So keep everything in source code as long as you can. That way, you allow the computer to do the work. And confuses everybody when you say, you know how big it can be, but you don't know how small it can be. Because if two things you're loading happen to share something, it's loading two things may be smaller than the sum of their sizes. This can confuse marketing no end. Binary libraries really don't work well on pipeline processors because it means you've got to clear out the pipe and restart the pipe for each of your functions. The other one, we made this mistake. A binary library like a Microsoft DLL is not a safe place to put secret information. Please don't do it. We fell into it. I raise it. What we do now is we run encrypted source code through a safe tool set and we decrypt inside the DSP. If you've got valuable IP in your audio, perhaps, you know, it may not to me seem valuable, it's the only source of your money for a company who's designing effects, then keeping your code safe is important. And the only real way we can do that was by decrypting inside the processor. I don't know of anybody else who does. Hardware with problems. Let's just have one continuous data type. The days of 20-bit coefficients and 24-bit data and asymmetrical multipliers and all that cobblers have gone. One data type, please. That was fine in the days before somebody realized that you might want to multiply the data by the data. You might want to do x squared, at which point you have to stuff x in both sides of the multiplier, and if they're different widths, you've got trouble. Private instruction sets are a pain in the ass. That, you know, the clever guy who thought up the three-way branch instruction to go with the Fortran three-way if statement and then found he needed to add boundaries to it. So, in fact, it took five of these three-way ifs to do one three-way. Crazy. Don't do it. We had a customer who sent us an algorithm as a benchmark. They wanted to know how long it would take and what the power and what the area would be to put a particular DSP algorithm, something like a boombox, into a processor. Gave it to a young engineer, did it in a week, sent it up to them. They said, can't be right. They tested it, was. But it took us a year. How did it take them a year? Somebody had written a diagram of a piece of DSP, amplifier, filter, stereo widener, and they then used a very small chisel to cut into a digital integrated circuit exactly that analog signal flow, except done with digits. So they were passing socking great big digital words across this piece of silicon. And of course, this whole thing ran basically at a clock rate of 96 kilohertz because it was stereo. So they were running silicon at 96K, huge piece of silicon, very slow. Don't do it. Use a processor. The thing that you're looking for is the ratio between the clock rate and the sample rate, because then you can do lots of instructions. Bi-quad coefficient ranges. There is a piece of example code that Analog Devices will send you for a Blackfin fixed point processor. What says you can do a bi-quad in 12 instructions or something. And you look at this, and the coefficient ranges, the regular old biquad, for both the feedback coefficients are plus or minus one. No bigger than that. What that means is there's a whole piece of the unit circle where you cannot put poles. the range you need is plus or minus 2. When we finally asked analog devices why they'd give an example code that wouldn't make any filter, they said it would have taken 2 more cycles and we would have lost out against TI on a benchmark. I tend to think that's very naughty. Giving somebody example code that won't actually do the job. I've talked this over with them, they admit it. It's in history. But you really do have to make sure your coefficient ranges are right. Feed-forward coefficients are a different thing. We've seen a processor that couldn't make gain. There was nowhere to put a shift. There was nowhere. The only way you could make gain was by adding A to A and getting yourself 6 dB of gain. Every time you want to make anything bigger, you have to add it to itself. I hope we never see another one of those. But there is a manufacturer out there with a processor that does exactly that. The accumulator is dead. When everybody thought that sums of products was what everybody would need from a single processor, the accumulator made some sense. You know, multiply A by A, sum it. Multiply B by C, sum it. Big FIRs, that sort of thing. Modern algorithms simply aren't all sums of products. Look inside any of these surround faking things. Look inside almost any piece of modern audio processing. It's not sums of products. Yes, if you're building a big sample rate converter, you probably want a big FIR machine. But for any of these other things, they're simply not sums of products. It makes building... the other thing with accumulators, it makes building compilers hell. If you have to go to double precision, you're probably in the wrong processor. Choose a better filter structure or choose a different number of bits. It works much better than double precision, which we've never had to use so far. If you must have an accumulator, make sure you can unload it and reload it. I can tell you one processor where you could not unload the bottom half of the accumulator. Because the idea is we were building a big FIR, so you're multiplying a short thing by a short thing to make a long thing and accumulating it. And the answer you'd want at the end of that accumulation was the top. And there was no way of unloading the bottom. So if you wanted to save the state of the accumulator and bring it back, you couldn't do it. Crazy. You need shifting for gain. I once built a machine that would shift all the way to 32 bits. We never used it. We looked through the library of code that the programmers had used. They never got above a shift of 7. You don't have to put huge shifts in. They never get used. Shift after the multiplier. Again, we know one machine where the shift is before the multiplier. It's completely bloody useless. If it takes you more than five clock ticks to do a biquad, you've got the wrong machine. It really shouldn't. Simple delays should not involve making extra instructions. Modulo arithmetic will get you there with a rotating memory. You need to start pipelines clearly, and I've got this wrong on a couple of occasions. If you think about a pipeline that starts with an instruction and then feeds it through, all these bits at the end of the pipe, when you come out of reset, will start throwing garbage into the following things. It can take you a very long number of weeks to find out where that odd piece of garbage came from. It ain't always easy. I've done it wrong at least twice. I'm working on the theory that since experience is recognizing a mistake the third time you make it, that I'm going to get experience in the next time we do this. Debugging. Debugging. You have source-level debuggers in every other piece of the universe. Why the hell don't we have? Why the hell isn't it mandatory and expected to have source-level debuggers for DSP? Anybody who's writing any sort of programming anywhere will have the source up and follow the execution and be able to examine things. The things we're processing in a DSP are signals. So your debugger needs to deal with signals, not instructions and not memory locations. So having a numeric value for what a number is all very fine and dandy, but it doesn't tell you anything. What you need to be able to do is get the signal out and listen to it, or stick in your AP, or do some analysis in MATLAB or something. You need to pass signals in and out of a signal processor when you're debugging, not integer values. You know, you need a scope, you need a signal generator. Yes, and it's addressed by instruction, not by location, because one memory location may have more than one signal in it. Now, a bit of recorded live. Why do they say recorded live? It doesn't make any sense. What I'm going to show you is a piece of real audio DSP programming. I'm using our tool set because I know it, but it's the sort of thing you should expect whoever's processor you're using. This is just a little piece of stuff from a little company who make little processors. We don't have billions of dollars to invest. But if somebody who has got billions of dollars to invest comes along and tries to sell you a DSP and insists you program it in assembler, just say no. Here we go. I'll take you through it. This is Simulink by MATLAB. It's a thing for doing simulation. So this is not our product. This is MATLAB's product. And here we've got a couple of constants and a display. And in between them, we're going to put an adder. And the two constants both have one in them. And when I run it, I get two in the display. Wow. Few tens of thousands software license per year to get 1 + 1 = 2. But what we do have that comes from us is a bit accurate set of models that match the programming of our processor. So here I'm going to take a constant. Note the beautiful pink color. Anything you see in pink is ours. And an adder. And all these instructions, except one we'll see later, limit. So I've got a constant and another constant, and I'm going to hang a display on. Since there's no display in our processor, that's an ordinary Simulink display. And when I run it, the one thing I have to tell it before, since it's bit accurate, I have to tell it the bit width of our processor, anywhere between 16 and 48, that we're running with. So I've just told it 24 bits. And I run it and I go 0 + 0 = 0. Brilliant. So we'll put a value in that constant, 0.5. A value in that constant, 0.25. Press the go button on Simulink and get 0.75. And as I say, because we only ever do bit accurate work. It's another thing I can't stand people doing is saying, we got a simulation, it's not bit accurate, but it'll give you an idea of what it'll sound like. So, simply going to change the display there to a hex display and find out it's a bit accurate. So now we'll build a real piece of stuff. I'm going to link this coefficient to a knob, in fact, a fader, on our real-time debugging environment. And that add wrap is the only instruction in our environment which doesn't limit. It goes over the top. And here's my z to the minus one, here's my delay. So I'm taking a number in, and I keep adding it to itself, and I'm making a sawtooth wave. Up and up and up and up and up. Oops, I've meet plus one, comes down, up and up and up. I take the sawtooth, run it through an abs, and I've gone from making a sawtooth to a triangle wave. Goes up, comes down, goes up, comes down. I multiply an input audio signal by that. I also have to put a version number in. And since I don't want the version number in the code, there's Pac-Man to eat it. For those who really do design silicon, it's like a gate eater. It'll eat everything that comes before it. Very useful if you've made a stereo object and you only want a mono one. Wire up the left channel, put Pac-Man on the right channel. It will eat out all the processing that was only used for that output. So you've automatically got a mono EQ when you built a stereo one. Saves a bit of time. Now, because MATLAB does everything in arrays and we do everything in samples, there's a bit of superstructure going in the Simulink world now to turn what's basically a flow of samples here to a flow of buffers there, because the only way MATLAB and Simulink understand things is as buffers full, whereas we're a sample company. So there's my input and output wired up. The other thing is that since Simulink doesn't have any real-time controls you can move. I have to fake the real-time control by feeding a constant in. So now I've got my complete design. And we can simulate it. This is real-time stuff, folks. We put two scopes on, one on the envelope and one on the signal, just to show you what's going on. But that's essentially what Simulink does using our block set. But the magic is that now I've done that, I've also programmed it for a real-time processor. So I can now go over and, for some reason, type rather than use a script. I suppose we were just trying to be honest and show you what happens. We extract the connectivity out of the Simulink. We then run it through our compiler. The input to our compiler is a Simulink netlist. The output is the code that runs on the DSP. There it is compiling. Doesn't take very long, a couple of seconds, I hope. Almost seems longer than it should be. There it's made the code from that diagram. I can now, it's buried in a DLL just to get it into our real-time debugger. We start up the real-time debugger, which has intentionally ugly colors, so it'll never leave R&D and turn into a product. That failed. And now it's loading the program via I2S into a chip by a big manufacturer containing one of our processors, which we use for R&D and playing around. Rather nice once they put your chip in there, your processor in their chip. You can use their chips to design other chips. I'm going to play some audio through it. This is the fader that's controlling the frequency of the up and down. It's a ring mod. Horrible noise, but made in under a minute. And if the programming environment you get from your DSP vendor won't do something as quick as that, then they've really not got much of an excuse. The next slide.
How many of them do do something as quick as that?
Some of them are quite good. I suppose the best ones you get these days are the people who've got a really decent C compiler, and they just produce a complete C IDE and go for it. There are some people who do graphic linkers, where what they take are blocks, you know, EQ, mixer, AEC, echo canceller, etc., and allow you to string those together graphically. So that's a linker. What we're doing here is a compiler, since it goes all the way down to individual instructions. And it goes in things like that. I like that as a shot of my clients. Because some people recognize some of the names. So if you pick up any of those devices, it's got this stuff in it because it works. And you shouldn't really be expecting anything less from your DSP. And the really fun bit from us was, this is these guys queuing up to buy the first day of one of our products. And they actually were a lot taller, but this was made 4x3, but that projector wants to do that, so they're not actually that short. Anyway, how do we make DSP easier? Get the algorithm away from the hardware. Use hardware for which there is a decent compiler and set of tools. Or if you're like us, and we have a company that basically has one room, and in this room, you can hear the whole problem because you can hear the engineers shout. There's a listening room as well. There'll be a processor designer at one desk, and he'll be thinking about multipliers and adders and memory and silicon. Next to him, there's a bloke who's got to write the compiler for it. And you have a wonderful discussion going on. Because this guy says, hey, I've thought of this really neat instruction. And this guy says, there's no way I can develop code for it. Throw it away. And then this guy comes along and says, I don't care. That doesn't do what I want to design my signal processing. So you need to get those three people next to each other. They've got different talents. They work in completely different environments. He's a DSP man. He's got ears with luck. He's probably a C writing young lad who's come out of a computer science course on how to write compilers. And he's a silicon junkie. But if you can get them to talk to each other, you can get a better final result. That's the end. So please shout at me about the things I've said that are wrong.
Thank you very much, Peter. Now, I make that a time compaction of about 400,000 to 1, 40 years in just over an hour, and certainly that triangle waveform took me back where places will remember. Can you manage a few questions?
Absolutely love them. There are at least two people in this room who know the truth behind all this because they've worked on it.
Can I kick off just by saying that at the AES conference last week, Dave Malam suggested that quadraphonics, as we knew them in the 70s, could never have got any further without DSP.
I know little about quadraphonics, ambiphonics, stereophonics, any of those. But I suspect he's well right. And we've been having a wonderful time doing things that were never possible in analog. Funniest one was plotting filter responses. If you're going to plot a filter response with a sweep, the traditional analog way would be you run a sweep in, you know, sine wave sweep, your analog electronics, and then you've got some sort of RMS low-pass filtered envelope following voltmeter thingy on the end, which is going to follow the output level, and you plot one against the other with a, you know, it used to be bits of mechanics and motors and a pen plotter and... But there's another way of doing it if you're doing it in digits, because you take two of your filters or equalizers or whatever, and the sweep you put in, particularly nice if somebody's built a stereo one, you put two sweeps in, left and right. Well, the left one is a cosine sweep, but the right one is a sine sweep, 90 degrees away. And when they come out the end, you square both of them and add it together. Yeah, these two signals in digits have been 90 degrees apart. These two vectors have been spinning round. And when you get them out, they come out a different size. And what you're actually interested in is the diagonal. So it's sum of squares, yeah, Pythagoras. And there's no low-pass filter required. You've got the response of the filter. There's a single short-time valid variable. And you could never do that in analog because you could never have two of the filter you were investigating that you knew to be the same. Whereas in digits, I can take two filters and absolutely know they're the same filter. And I can apply this sort of 90 degree phase shift IQ from the software radio people method of measuring things. It works quite nicely. So yeah, I agree with him. There's things you can do in digits that you can never have done in analog. Any?
I was intrigued by your bemoaning of the use of floating point general purpose processors. I can see why that's a problem if you've got the luxury of designing your own silicon. If you're using something off the shelf, why would a 32-bit floating point processor be any worse than 24-bit fixed point when it comes to performance?
Because you've just consumed 33% more power and area.
Okay. If micropower is not your
lovely
concern.
Quote from von Neumann.
Okay.
You know, the computer man, a real programmer never needs floating point because he knows in his head where the decimal point should, where the binary point should be. Now, I don't go quite that far. I see that floating point is wonderfully useful for some things. I'm just talking about audio DSP, and particularly audio DSP for commercial things where money matters. You know, if you're in the middle of the military or in the middle of education, you're trying out ideas, do the floating point thing. It's much easier. But if you're down to the wire where battery life is king, and it is with everything that fits in your pocket, battery life is the pain in the arse. Wire should be wiggling more wires than I absolutely have to, because it's wiggling the wires takes the power. I can get I mean, essentially, apart from two or three bits of the exponent in floating point, none of the rest of the bits of the exponent are giving you anything for an audio application in general. But this is a discussion that's been going on, usually alcohol-fueled, in a bar at AES conventions for some number of decades now. It's been quite fun looking back over 40 years, because when I began doing this sort of thing in that studio, I could get two flip-flops in a square inch of printed circuit board. That makes you really, really, really efficient in your electronic design of digital systems, because every single gate or flip-flop you put down is going to increase the size of the machine. And that 6-foot rack was, you know, a large object. At the moment, the same processing is in one of our clients' chips in under a square millimeter. What then happened is the synthesizer people arrived. Not EMS like I used to work for, but the silicon synthesis people. And they wrote programs that would take a disgusting language called Verilog, or an equally disgusting language, and try to turn it into gates automatically. And the early ones, there's a couple of professionals of this in the room, so I have to be careful. The early ones were crap. They would essentially produce bloat. You know, anything you could, as long as it did the right thing. And they were sometimes not even sure if it did the right thing. But they would produce really unwieldy, large designs, but at least they would do it quickly. That was all fine and dandy until cell phones arrived and the pocket revolution happened. At which point, bloat, they'd pay for the silicon, but they couldn't pay for the milliwatts. The battery life thing. And so suddenly you got to a point where all those old skills of compact digital design became valuable again. They either became valuable to the people writing synthesis programs or to the people using them, but we went through a hump of inefficiency at one point in building silicon, and we're now back building much more efficient silicon because power is one of the key things that you have to economize on. The other thing I should say is we spend a lot of time putting our processor into hybrid chips. That's things that have got analog and digital. So they've got ADCs and DACs, headphone drivers, class D amps, microphone preamps, all sorts of stuff in there, as well as a digital processor. Now, the problem there is that, for the nanometer savvy, modern sort of, if you pick up a today's Pentium, what are they, 22 nanometer, Richard, something like that? They're running with feature sizes of 22 nanometers. You can't do that on a hybrid chip. On most hybrid chips, your feature size is 180 nanometers. So the transistors is big, because they are 180 over 22 squared times as large. So it's very important in hybrid chips, where you've got some digits sharing it with some analog, that the digits involves the absolute minimum of area. So we sell a processor which we call tiny because it is, and we sell it mainly to people who have great big transistors because they're in hybrid. So efficiency is the fun. And of course, the other problem, of course, with big transistors is different power requirements. Sorry. Go on about that for hours.
Well, thank you, Peter. Before
One more question in front. Right, you appear to share my dislike of assembler and the C language. So what do you use?
I program in C day and night because it works what I do. I have younger engineers who program in other languages, and we occasionally have wonderful problems. Had a wonderful one with a younger engineer about a month ago. He got handed a project from one of our customers. It was an algorithm. It was essentially develop an algorithm and run it on a DSP. And he came along and said, I've done it. Got it programmed. What's it in? Python. Great. A nice, very high-level language in which you can do all sorts of things natively. And he did that in about a month, got a new algorithm. And then we had, and he was just about to say we can deliver it to the client real soon. And of course, you've then got another month to take this high-level description of the language, of the algorithm he discovered, which was very clever, to get it into the DSP. So there's this thing the computer science people do that and I'm only sort of a watcher of all this, about levels of languages. Personally, I'm trying to get as low as I can without becoming machine-specific. That means I end up programming regular old C and I can get C programmers off the shelf. But big things, and that Simulink MATLAB thing, I've never used it. We've got young guys who swear by it. They've all been polluted in university. Because MATLAB very cleverly almost give the university's licenses. So all the students come out and they believe they can program because they can write MATLAB. They then turn up on a bench in my room and go, where's the MATLAB? Have you got the money to pay for a commercial license? No, neither have I. And depending on what toolboxes you want and all this. Then again, we're a partner with them on some work. So I'm not bad-mouthing them, but it's a question of different levels of programming. And what I'm trying to do is to do some compaction on those levels to reduce the amount of time between getting the algorithm and listening to it and getting it in the product.
Thank you, Peter. Okay.